to my office.
Anyway, all right, let's get started. So here is the excerpt that kind of frames why I was thinking about tonight being the 75th, today being the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. It's called All the Gallant Men by Donald Stratton, one survivor's unforgettable story of unfathomable courage at Pearl Harbor told in full for the first time. So it's really an amazing excerpt, an amazing story about this soldier, this serviceman who was on the USS Arizona. And then the end of the story is how he was rescued by another man on a ship right nearby. And this particular soldier, he spent 10 months recovering in a military hospital and suffered burns on more than 65% of his body. But after he had been discharged, of course, medically, he actually re-enlisted and served as a gunner's mate in the Pacific toward the end of the war, which is just amazing. You know, you think about the people who fought in this war, and to me, a lot of those people, they're just made from, they cut from different cloth. You know, we're
soft.
We're just soft. You know, last week in Ortora, they had a scholar residence. We got to hear from Yosef Mendelevich. So Yosef Mendelevich, he just described how in the gulag, so they told him that if he wanted to see his father for his once a year visit, he would have to take off his kippah because they had been trying to find ways for him to stop wearing his kippah. He's like, no. So he didn't see his father for 7 years until his father died because he wasn't going to take off his kippah. Of course he's not going to take off his kippah. I'm like, it's just like a different, it's just an unbelievable thing. It was one of the refuseniks who spent 11 years in prison, and he just wrote a book about his experiences. Came to eventually, of course, when the KGB let him out, they kicked him out of Russia, which is exactly what he had been asking for a long time ago. But these people, they're just cut from a different cloth. I had a grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, who was in the infantry in World War II. He wasn't like, you know, hanging around in the back somewhere. He was literally on his hands and knees, living in a tent in France, shooting a rifle, killing Germans as best as he could until he was shot and then sent back to England. So it's just, when you think about Pearl Harbor, you think about that Tekufa and the people that served, it immediately brings to mind the whole concept of Mesiras Nefesh, you know, people risking their lives and giving their lives for something that was greater than themselves. And that is an important Mussar Haskel today when we struggle with how to deal with eradicating evil from the world. And there is terrible evil, unspeakable evil that's going on today in the world. We're living it in the year 2016. You would think that by 2016 there wouldn't be, but there is. The New York Times just published, I couldn't read anything past the first paragraph about some of the things that ISIS are doing to women in the places that they conquer. I couldn't read it after the first paragraph. I'm still mezazea when I think about it. And so we think about what it means to sacrifice for something that's greater than ourselves. So some people here have children who have made tremendous sacrifices like this. But it's a time to reflect and pause. These people who served, they were, in America, they called it being in the service. That's what it was. It was being in the service because you were in the service of something greater. So I think that was the first thing that came to mind, just kind of b'derech klal. But then when you think about the significance of remembering, the concept of zechira, which looms large in a Jewish consciousness. So you talk about Pearl Harbor, and we refer to it as a day that will live in infamy. So the concept of remembering specific events appears in a long time ago in the Jewish tradition. There used to be something called Megillas Tainis. Megillas Tainis was the days on which you fast. And it's discussed in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yud Ches Amud Beis, where the Gemara debates, does it still operate? So we assume Megillas Tainis doesn't operate, except for, we'll see Chanukah soon, it appears in Megillas Tainis, we still observe it. The Gemara says, Persumi Nisa. But in the old days, we had a whole list, you know, a chronicle of fast days. Why? Well, because this happened on this day, and this was this day of infamy, and this catastrophe happened, and that calamity happened. So the idea of marking and remembering calamities is certainly something that we're mindful of. So even though today we don't observe Megillas Tainis, but the idea of saying, yeah, you need to pause and reflect on some significance of this day, it's very much a part of who we are. Now, on the other hand, it's interesting that in this work, it's a very important book about Jewish history and historiography called Zachor by, he was a Columbia professor for a very long time. His name is Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. So Yerushalmi wrote a very important book called Zachor, where he points out that after the close of the Tanakh, Chazal were not really interested in history per se. Like, you can learn Midrashim and you'll find a very, very extreme formulation of like Noach having a conversation with Og Melech HaBashan, who then visits David HaMelech, or something like that, where you're clearly, they're bending the whole concept of time and the idea of that the donkey of Avram Avinu appears again as the donkey of something. Like, those concepts, they're clearly ahistorical. But even beyond that, Chazal, if you look through the Gemara, they're not really interested in recording history. As much as Tanakh is very particular about a lot of historical points, even though, of course, Tanakh is not a history book. Like, I'm learning Sefer Melachim now with my son Chaim, and he noted, like, we're getting to the kings, you know, there's a lot of changeover from one king to the next, but one king is like, well, he ruled for 41 years, and then you move on. It's like, that's his whole 41 years, is one pasuk, or something like that. So Chazal, excuse me, the Tanakh, it's not a history book like we would call a history book. You don't devote, you know, time just for the sake of time. It's about teaching you important lessons that the Rebbe Shalom wants to convey to us. So that's why it's not focused on that. But it's certainly historically based. It's very sensitive to historical events. Whereas in the Gemara, it's not like they're not interested so much in telling you about history. So that's kind of the counterbalance, that on the one hand, Zachor means to remember. On the other hand, to remember, it doesn't necessarily mean to document in history. We're very interested in remembering. We remember, he points out, through liturgy and through ritual. We don't necessarily remember through writing historical works. That starts to creep up in the Middle Ages. So then, and then more recently, of course, Jewish history and Jewish historiography is big. A lot of people make a living from that. But initially, that wasn't so much of interest. Chazal, perhaps, he has an interesting suggestion that Chazal viewed the Tanakh as not just a book of history, but also the entirety of history. So anything that's going to come after, you know, like the Ramban says at the end of Sefer Devarim, it's the Havtach of what's going to be. So I don't need to write the history now. It's all been foretold by the Torah and the prophets, which is an interesting thesis. But it's kind of like when you think about what does it mean to remember Pearl Harbor, or what does it mean to remember an event according to Jewish tradition, it's complicated. Because on the one hand, we have a lot of memories, but on the other hand, the time of Chazal, we don't have a lot of history. We have Megillas Tainus, but that's more of a ritual. That's more of an experience. So, it's a question. Well then, if that's such a good question, well why then would anybody waste their time? So why would you spend your time studying history? You know, like, why would you bother? So I think there are a couple of reasons why it would be worthwhile. Just, you know, you talk about remembering Pearl Harbor, but even studying. Some of us have had the chance to study World War II history. It was definitely something I've always been interested in. So Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, has an essay called The End of Learning in one of the Leaves of Faith volumes, where he talks about different aspects of learning. You know, there are different philosophies about learning. There's Torah only. Some institutions of higher Torah learning is Torah only. And then there are others that incorporate other aspects. And the question is, well, why? Isn't that just Bittul Torah? So Rav Lichtenstein points out, no, Rav Lichtenstein was a great giant of literature, not that that was his primary focus, but that augmented his Torah personality. And he says that the reason why this is significant, good literature, and I think it's probably equally true for history, at least I majored in history, so I have to make some justification, is he talks about how...
Augmented.
Yes?
But we all majored in Marin.
History?
Yeah. Marin.
Except for Scott.
No, something else, I assume.
Pre-Marin.
Science?
Science, right?
A real major.
Well, any questions, comments, or observations? That was where we started. So, Wilhelmstein points out that the study of the humanities is really the study of the human spirit. It's the story about the Tzelem Elokim, in a certain sense, of the person. So that, too, is the Bria of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam created human beings, and so that, too, is the study of the Tzelem Elokim. It's obviously not on par with actual Torah learning, but to find meaning in the kind of the context of what a person is studying in the corners of their life, so I certainly think that's true for the study of history and the study of world events and the way that people interact and the way that they relate to different things. I think there's, you know, even a simpler cause for studying history. You could call it the Musar Limud. You can learn a lot about life and about how to behave and how not to behave based on looking at history. People who are ignorant of history oftentimes haven't learned lessons that are patently obvious to people who spent 5 minutes studying case studies of different leadership styles, even just for example. And then On the most narrow, but very, very strong, is the Rabbah who makes the case in Hilchos Tainis, who says that, well, you know, when bad things happen, if you just say, well, it's just the course of history, it's not worth studying because, you know, it just happens. These things happen. They're just chance. The Rambam says that's callousness. That's achzarius. Not cruelty, but callousness, because you're not being sensitive to the messages that Hashem is sending. Now, that does not mean that if something bad happens, you can attribute it necessarily to something. Unless you're the accountant of the Ribbono Shalom, it's difficult to say with certainty what you can attribute these things to. But the idea of being sensitive to the messages that are happening and that are being sent to us is certainly something that people who are the students of history can, from a religious standpoint, can be very sensitive to. You could just pay attention and you ask yourself, what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu asking of us in this generation? You know, for Rav Kook, the Industrial Revolution was a big deal. The advent of all kinds of scientific discoveries, that was a big deal. You know, what does it mean for a Torah personality who now has to encounter, I don't know, Darwinism? So these are significant questions from a religious vantage point. And thinking about them can sharpen a person from their Torah makeup. So that's just a kind of a segment to think about why we should learn history, even in the context of whether or not Chazal studied history. So how does this, I think, bring us to Pearl Harbor itself? So I gave you on the first page what I think is quite fascinating. Instead of looking to the local papers, although we could have gone to the Chicago Tribune, I actually went to see how far, what was the reaction to Pearl Harbor in what was, now it's called the Jerusalem Post. This is the front cover of what was at that time called the Palestine Post. You see, Monday, December 8th, 1941. Look at this. Already then, they were selling bottled water. Could you imagine buying bottled water in 1941? Seriously. You know, I guess our kids aren't as spoiled as we thought they were in camp. Japan makes war on America, air attacks on Pearl Harbor and Manila. That's a little anachronistic. U.S. to declare war today following Tokyo declaration against America and Britain. And so here you have a series of cables flashed by Reuters from America on the Far East, which began arriving some 4 hours earlier. So the front page of the Palestine Post is telling you about what happened at Pearl Harbor, which of course was the surprise attack by the Japanese, which drew the United States informally into World War II. It brought into specific focus the Pacific Fleet of the United States and the naval aspect, the branch of service, which is quite an interesting thing. This year, you know, when I'm on vacation, usually I have time to read one book. So this year when I was on vacation, I read a very fascinating work called The Matthews Men. The Matthews Men is about a small county in Virginia called Matthews County, where the vast majority of merchant mariners were from. And it was about the battle between the German U-boats and the American merchant marine at the beginning of World War II. It's mamish very fascinating. And you see what these naval men, and those guys were not actually part of the Navy, they were just kind of subcontracted out by the government, what life is like when you're dodging U-boats, which were, by the way, floating right up and down the coast. They were, you know, near Atlantic Beach and not far from Coney Island and Miami. They were up and down the coast sinking ships every 5 minutes. It's really amazing when you think about these guys who are in a tin can floating in the middle of the ocean. Some of you are familiar with this story. I think it was made into a movie. I didn't see a movie, but I read the book called Unbroken, about this guy who, you know, was on a raft. I forget for how many days. I forget what he said. Then he went to a Japanese concentration camp. Zamperini, right. He went to a concentration camp. Unbelievable stories. So when you think about, you know, the Navy, it's a very serious business. So Pearl Harbor becomes a turning point, of course, in the war and of the course of history. But I think for tonight, it actually has a fascinating application, because after Pearl Harbor, it inspired a particular person who his Judaism unquestionably is going to suffuse his entire life and everything that he does. And he's a perfect person to look at kind of like as a microcosm when you think about Pearl Harbor. And who am I talking about? Hermann Wouk, who is now, I don't know if he's 101 or 102, But he just published his what he said was his last book, which I did not read yet. I read several of Hermann Wouk's books, but he's a very, very fascinating person. I think he lives in Palm Springs, somewhere in California, in a warm climate. He's over. He's still alive. He's still over 100. He just been 101. That's it. 1915. So he's still. He just cranked out his last book. So he was the child. He was born in New York. He was the child of. This is from his website. 1915 to Russian Jewish parents who emigrated from Minsk. His grandfather. His name was, I'll tell you, Rav Mendel Leib Levin, who was a Rav in Minsk, then in New York, and then in Tel Aviv. His grandfather lived 94 years, and he describes in his dedication here in this work, which we'll get to in a minute, his lifetime of 94 years stretched from the last days of Abraham Lincoln to the first years of the nuclear era. And he describes how when he published this book, which I'll tell you about in a minute, all of its earnings belong to a fund for charity and education established by his family in memory of his son who died. And so it's in memory of his grandfather and especially in honor of his son who passed away. His grandfather, Wouk writes, was one of the two people, the most influential people in his life. One of them was this grandfather. Another one was a totally secular professor of history. And his life is about fusing those two. His grandfather was a European Rav from Minsk. So here's this young man whose name is Hermann Wouk, who begins his literary career. He gets a BA at 19, and for 5 years he was a staff writer for Fred Allen. 1941, he goes to Washington to write radio scripts. And then after the attack on Pearl Harbor, he joins the Navy. And for those who are familiar with some of Hermann Wouk's books, the Navy features prominently. I don't know how many people here read War and Remembrance, or Winds of War. Those are two very, very thick books.
Yeah, that's about very, 6 inches each.
Yes.
I didn't go anywhere. So, actually, it bounced out a table, I think, once.
So some of my very enjoyable hours visiting my grandparents on Collins were spent reading those books.
I was about to say War and Peace. You mean War and Peace? That's the best
one. Winds of War was a big TV miniseries in the
80s, yeah, right? It was.
I like that.
It was like a long drive. What's that? These are World War II novels, historical fiction. They're like 800 pages each. Very big. But
Gina's third cheer of the day, by the way.
That is impressive.
Wednesday, Sunday, Carmel.
So you don't need to read War and Remembrance. You got three shoes today. You're done. But these are a lot of his books reflect, and there are different aspects of his naval career in those volumes because he lived that firsthand. So he joins the Navy. He serves on the USS Zane. And then he did 8 different Pacific invasions, battle stars. He was going to become a captain, but then his ship got destroyed in a typhoon. Amazing story. So then, of course, he goes on to a career in literature. And he's living this fascinating life that on the one hand, he's a writer. He's an American writer, American-born. On the other hand, he's a thoroughly Jewishly confused person, very, very devoted, so much so that he describes that before he went for his writing, these writers, they write like, I don't know, 8-10 hours a day. So he says before he goes to sit down at his writing table, he spends an hour learning Gemara in the morning. So first he learns for an hour, then he goes to sit down at his writing pad. That was his schedule. That's what he described. So I'm not one to check anybody else's tzitzis. I can't tell you how religious he was or not religious he was. There's no question that he is a person who is infused with Yadus, with Yiddishkeit. And he writes a book. This book was published in, was first published, I think it was in 59. Yeah, first published in 1959, called This Is My God, The Jewish Way of Life. There are many Jews who do not observe the religion, who would like to know a lot more about it. There are non-Jews too, who now and then grow curious about the old Hebrew faith. But the literature is so vast, it is usually so scholarly in tone, and so much of it is not in English, that such readers are often at a stand, not knowing where to begin. I offer this volume as a beginning. So Hermann Wouk is very much you know, loving Yiddishkeit. So he writes many, many works, most of them historical fiction. But there was an article that I came across in my searching and preparation. Take a look at this article by Edward Shapiro that was published in American Jewish History magazine, called The Jew as Patriot, Hermann Wouk and American Jewish Identity. This is on page 2. So what does he write? I take out one snippet for you, because he goes through different aspects of Wouk's writings and different scholarly reviews. But look what he writes here. For students of American history, and particularly of American Jewish history, Wouk's significance lies not in his contribution to American literature or to the history of World War II. Rather, it is in his definition of American Jewish identity. In his analysis of Marjorie Morningstar, Fiedler remarks that Wouk seeks an end to, quote, surly intransigence among the Jews, end quote. Wouk's view of American Jewish identity goes far beyond that. In 6 novels and in a preface to the letters of Yoni Netanyahu, Jonathan Netanyahu, the hero of the Israel rescue of the Jewish hostages at Entebbe in 1976, Wouk articulates a symbiosis between American identity and Jewish identity, an intertwining of American and Jewish fates in which the Jew is a patriot and the preeminent defender of American institutions and values. Wouk's own life anticipated this effort. So what do we have? We have what we can call in Hebrew a shiluv, a synthesis between your identity as an American, as a patriot, as someone who's going to serve in the Navy, and as somebody who lives a Jewish, and not just Jewish, but a fully infused life of Judaism. So to express this, he has a fascinating observation. If you look at the next page, I give you the title page to This Is My God. And then go to the next page, on page 4, where he has a letter, and this is a section, subsection called The Core of Judaism. Anybody want to read this? Well, maybe we'll break it up in small pieces. Everybody can volunteer a little bit. The letter from the agnostic. Go ahead.
I have on my desk a letter from an agnostic friend, part of a running correspondence many years old. Says he, what is the core of being a Jew? To be different in living habits, for a practical moral way of life based on behavior and behavior. Why, in some significant measure, the terrible problems of social existence on a crowded planet are solved by refusing to be doctors seems irretrievably petty to me.
Okay, so this agnostic wants to know, what's the core of Yiddishkeit? How does that affect anything? So how does Wouk respond? Anybody who wants to pick it up? Karen, you want to pick it up? It's English. It's all right.
The second paragraph?
Yeah, the pious reader.
The pious reader may not agree, but I think this is excellently put. Once I think I made a similar point, though much more crudely, about naval service.
Okay, so now listen to this. He's going to use the Navy as a muscle for Yiddishkeit. Go ahead.
I had been...
Midshipman, some kind of officer, I don't know exactly.
Of weeks, and I was nailed with a
demerit
for incorrect use of words. Yeah. I growled to my room mate as a
tyrannical ensign, which means it was his officer.
Walked off. How will it help beat the Japanese if I call a staircase a ladder?
Okay, it's a good question, right? You know, who really cares? All right, who's picking it up? Who's next? Gina, it's your third cheer of the day. You can do this in your sleep.
Yeah. I eventually learned to do so. It is not my impression that I thereby advanced the surrender ceremonies in Tokyo Bay, say from September 5th to September 2nd, but I am pretty sure that I became a useful naval officer in part by learning the lingo and whatever minute service I gave towards that surrender. I gave it as a naval officer. Possibly because the Navy meant I have always thought that the Jewish place among mankind somewhat resembles the position of a Navy man among other Americans.
Is this an interesting mashal? Okay, let's keep going.
Are the sailors and officers of America because they are in the Navy? They have special commitments and different odd ways of dress, sharp limits on their freedom. They have, at least in their own minds, compensations of glory for the vital service performed. The Jews are not cut off from mankind by their faith, though they are marked different. They have their special disciplines and, at least in their own minds, their rewards.
Who wants to pick it up?
I remember being looked up to as a naval officer in wartime. And when peace came and I traveled to take my reserve cruises, people in trains and planes tended to regard me as an unfortunate misfit. One or two actually said, "How come you're still in?" I think that is essentially the question that agnostics address to observant Jews. "You're still in, I suppose, because we get out of faith that the law of Moses is from God, and our observation tells us that the patterns of the law help keep our tiny folk in life in the grand sweep of history. We share the hope of our fathers and that of our tiny folk. In some way, none of us can foresee the light of lasting peace will someday come. I cannot produce the Messiah, but in my sons, as providence allows, I can produce two informed Jews who will keep alive and hope beyond my life."
Is that beautiful or what?
That's beautiful.
Terrific, right? The mashal of the naval officer as the observant Jew. So now he goes back to the agnostic. He says, okay, you asked me, well, what's Yiddishkeit about? Is it about all these minute details, or is it about being nice to other people? So he says, look, here's the difference. There's a distinction to be made. He said, there's the core of Yiddishkeit. The core is how you treat other people. He invokes the story of Hillel and the Ger. The guy says, what am I supposed to know? Hillel tells him, treat other people the way, don't do to others like you don't want to do to yourself. But then he says so sharply on the last paragraph, he says, okay, that's the core. The core of a nuclear reactor or an apple or of a religion is not all of it. We make few core decisions day by day. Life is too packed with running trivialities, with mechanical repetition. Judaism does not let that part of life go. It weaves commitment and therefore at least formal significance all through one's day. So yes, it does matter how what you eat, what you put in your mouth. Is what you put in your mouth, you know, the central aspect, definitional quality of Yiddishkeit, whether you eat lobster or fake crab? That's not the definitional quality, but it's certainly a piece of it. And if you understand that just as a naval officer has to keep his boots shined and he has to refer to the stairway as a stairway, because that is all of what it means to be a put together, a whole integrated naval officer. So you can understand how you're right. That's not the definition of Yiddishkeit, but that's a big piece of it. And you can't just go and chip away and say, you know what, I decided that's not really important. So
I'm not going to do that.
Exactly. So it's such a beautiful articulation of what a fully observant life is all about. How it's a balance between understanding the significance of the core, but also understanding the significance of the details. So here you see Pearl Harbor, Herman Wouk, mamish spot on in terms of using this experience of his American naval service as a model for Yiddishkeit. But I think you could take it a step further. And I think he takes it a step further, which is perfect timing because it relates to Hanukkah. Because if what Wouk is living, and this is a good example, this essay is showing how you can have a synthesis. You can be a fully integrated Jew, and he describes, I forget somewhere where, he describes about how the Navy was very accommodating to him eating kosher. You could be a fully integrated Jew and be a patriot and serve your country. But at the same time, it's not so simple. There are tensions. Go to the next page go to page 6. That's the end of that paragraph. I'm not going to take more time on that. So this is what he writes about Hanukkah. And I think it gets to the core of the tension that is inherent in what he's trying to establish. He's trying to establish a synthesis between being American, a patriot, and being an observant Jew. What's the tension? I think the tension is manifest here, perhaps, in the Hanukkah story. So first, he goes through the history of Hanukkah, because he has a section in the book. This section starts over here. What is it?
It's 76.
Yeah. In the section, the previous point was in the section on, and this is part two called The Faith. So first he has something about learning, which is what we just did. Then he has a piece on Shabbos, a bunch of pages. Then he has a section called The Nature Festivals. And then, after the Nature Festivals, He has a section on the high holidays and the minor holy days. So at the end of the minor holy days, he talks about Hanukkah. So he gives you the history. And then he tells you Hanukkah today. Who wants to pick it up first? Go ahead. I have
here summarized the Hanukkah story because it is not, like the Bible narratives, part of the common Western culture. In 1,000 years of national existence on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, a battle for religious liberty, alone found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them in the next 2,000 years. Namely, can a small people, dwelling in a triumphant major culture, take part in the general life and yet hold to its identity, or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority? In the two great worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, which so much resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical, free West, they face the question again.
Okay, so now he's going to break it down along those two lines. And of course, this is published in 1959, which is...
the heart of communism.
Exactly. The Cold War is as frigid as ever. Okay.
The communist position on the Jews is generally, though with less crudity, that of Antiochus. Our religion, the Soviets consider a barbarous relic, superseded in wisdom and soundness by Marxism. The training of children in this exploded Semitic superstition goes against good sense and interests of the state. So the police discourage such teaching in ways sometimes oblique and sometimes forcible. For Greek religion substitute Marxism, and the Russian Jews are back where their fathers were in 168 BC, with whatever differences one may find in the relative truth and beauty of the Greek and communist cultures.
So that's on one hand, the struggle, the model of Hanukkah in a contemporary context. Okay? Anybody? So he's saying, what did the Greeks do? The Greeks outlawed religion. And that's exactly what the Soviets were doing. You know, you couldn't get a chumash. That's what this fellow Yosef Mendelevich was describing. He says, you know, in prison, he was only allowed to have books that were published in Russia, but they couldn't publish chumashim. So he had glued in a cover page of something to pretend it was Yiddish, pretend that it was published in Russia, in the Soviet Union. But there was no free expression of religion. There was a terrible clampdown. That's why there was this whole underground movement. He describes, when he was here, he described how he grew up, there was no education, and he and his friends, he was in prison. He went to different prisons. At one point, he was on the other side of the wall from Sharansky, because they were in the same, you know, they were dissident chevra, and they had an underground network of educational institutions, because there was no free enterprise of chinuch. So they had secret educations. It's literally like under their noses. And he's saying it's a perfect parallel. You know, like the Midrashim described, the Jews couldn't learn Torah, so they had to play Dreidelach or whatever. People came. They said, oh, what are you doing? Nothing. The Greek centuries. It's very similar to the anti-Jewish legislation that was in Russia. And he's even taking it on a conceptual, theoretical level, where the Greeks said, we have an ideology, and we're going to impose that ideology. Now, it's more complicated. I'm oversimplifying, because you know that the Seleucid Greeks, Antiochus, was one segment of a broken Greek empire that had splintered after the death of Alexander the Great. It splintered into different components. But the idea was, we have this way of life, we have this culture, and we think that it supersedes anything that you have, so we're going to stamp out the local cultures, which what we call Yadus, Yiddishkeit. So that's exactly what the Soviets were saying. Where the Soviets are saying, we know better. You know, Stalin and Marx and Lenin, these people, they set out the utopian value system for us. So whatever you're drinking, it's wrong. Spill it out. Burn the books. It's terrible. It's very much exactly the parallel. So he's saying one parallel of a challenge of Hanukkah today is the anti-Semitism and anti-religious life in communist Russia. That's piece number one. Piece number two, who wants to pick it up?
The challenge of the West is different, though just as serious.
The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. The position of the government, and indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers and ought to do so. What contradicts them is the title force that
De Tocqueville
long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase, the tyranny of the majority. The pressure to emulate neighbors, the urge to conform to popular views and manners, the deep fear of being different, these in the United States are the forces of Antiochus. Where the power of the sword long ago failed, the power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better.
There you go. So what's the other side of Hanukkah, the other challenge? It's not where somebody says to you, either, like they said to Mendelevich, they said, either take off your kippah, and if you do, you can go visit your father, or keep your kippah on, and we'll keep you in the gulag for another year. It's a different challenge. It's the tyranny of the majority. And here, I think, is the tension that is inherent in the synthesis that Hermann Wouk is trying to model. Because there is a risk, and there is a cost, there is a danger in saying that I can be a proud American patriot and also be an observant Jew. Because as much as you identify with and become enmeshed in that culture, you run the risk of being overwhelmed by the need to emulate the people who are around us, the culture that we're becoming a part of.
That was 1959, you said, you wrote
that? Yes.
Now I don't think there's as much of a sense of today. There's so many more cultures. I don't think you, like, and then you were living in a neighborhood with all your neighbors were probably all Catholic or Protestant or something. Now you have so many things going on, it seems probably a little bit less pressure because so many things, people are doing their own thing. But in 1959,
interesting.
More conformist. You know.
That's interesting. On the other hand, you might say that the influences today, the pervasiveness of the secular influences out there. Look, I've never been on a secular college campus. I've never been there. I went to YU. I was in graduate school in YU. I learned in YU until I came to Chicago. But from what I hear from people who are on secular campuses, that there is a pervasive pressure, that there is a challenge to not conform, because there are so many, whether it's, you know, we have many...
You do your own thing, start your own new thing. Whatever.
Right, but it's hard. It's hard. People say, well, they want to get into this fraternity. Well, that means they have to do A, B, and C. And so, you know, I've had some conversations with some of the wonderful young people from our community who have gone to different places, and they describe some of the challenges that exist out there in that world. So even though in certain sense it's different, I would say in a certain sense it's become more challenging. Right. It's become more challenging because the kids are out there, and even we, you know, we have become second or third generation American to say that, of course, you know, we embrace. And in our community, I think this is this tension, putting these two pieces from Hermann Wouk together is so important. Because we run the risk of saying, well, we believe in, you know, Torah Umada, centrist orthodoxy, engaging the world, modernity. So does that mean that we buy wholesale everything that's out there? Is that there's like some, there's no filter? We're indiscriminately engaging and subscribing to whatever is going on out in the world? I should hope not. Because if we are, we're going to just end up with a completely Hellenized, which is why there are a lot of segments of the religious Jewish community and the Orthodox community they say that we're making a terrible mistake. And people are going to go off the derech because they're going to get swallowed up by the tyranny of the majority because they're not going to be able to withstand the pressures. And there's some, you know, there is more than just anecdotal evidence to support that concern. On the other hand, we believe that that is perhaps the calling of our community and what the Ribbono Shel Olam expects of us. So then that brings us back to the Hanukkah message, which is exactly what he's talking about. It's how, on the one hand, do we celebrate Hanukkah in America, but on the other hand, not diminish the message of Hanukkah, not lose the message of Hanukkah. And the message of Hanukkah is exactly that. It's a maintaining your Jewish identity. So I think it's kind of, it's an open book because it's an ongoing struggle. That, I think, is really the takeaway, at least for me, from this vantage point of the story of Hermann Wouk and what this small aspect is trying to tell us, that we, who are reading Herman Wouk, who are going to the library and going on Amazon and buying not just Sifrei Kodesh and reading these different books, and are enmeshed in and engaged in the culture around us, like good officers, like good beacons of light, and at the end of that previous paragraph, he thinks that that's what we should be doing. We should be that Orla Goyim, so to speak, that naval officer vis-a-vis the other citizens. But at the same time, we have to recognize that it's a challenge. If we think that it's just going to be, you know, shalom alai nafshi, everything is going to be fine, we can go out into the world and think that we can, without difficulty, navigate the issue of being an American Jewish patriot, then I think we're fooling ourselves. And when we do that, we run the risk of falling prey to the silent majority. So when we think about what it means to be a Jewish American, I think we, especially in our community, need to be constantly having this conversation of how do we navigate this tension and not just go with it because, well, our friends are doing it, our parents did it. That's what the motto of our, you know, Dr. Pelkis likes to say, every family has a bumper sticker. You know, for some bumper stickers, it's Harvard or bust. Some it's like Mir or bust. You know, every family has a bumper sticker. So our community has certain bumper stickers. But that doesn't mean that just because we have that bumper sticker, so that means that we kind of have, you know, given away the responsibility, the serious responsibility to take our Yiddishkeit seriously in navigating this role as being Jewish Americans. So that was, I think, one of the things that we can take away from Herman Wouk, who, to me, personifies, from a Jewish perspective, something to think about on Pearl Harbor Day, 75 years later. So there you have it.